Welcome back to the Rude Dude Podcast, the show that puts some pep in your step, takes some weight off your plate, and reminds you haters are going to hate, but you are loved. We are your hosts and favorite recovering alcoholics, Cameron the Creedy, Penny Lokes the Lobbed Man X. How you doing there, Cree?
You know what, man? I'm doing pretty good, man. It's like 87 degrees in Sacramento, which is nice. Got a little bit of a sinus headache, so that's not elite. But I'm hella hyped to be here today, dude. I'm excited for this interview. And you can tell that you're getting back to normal, dude, because you know what? That intro really did have a little bit of extra pep in it, bro. Like there's life back. It was a welcome, and it got me all sorts of fucking excited, dude. So how are you doing, bro?
Well, I knew I had to put a little more into it because last intro was a little Eeyore because I knew that what was coming. I knew I had to pay the piper, by the way, which was the phrase I was looking for last week that I couldn't find. Also think it's hilarious that it was 87 in Sacramento, so it was really nice today and cool, and it was 80 here, and I was sweating my ass off dying building a deck, so...
Yeah, dude. Well, we're like the surface of the sun in the summer, as you're aware of. So, I mean, 87, dude. I might as well be in San Diego today. It was elite out here.
All right. Well, we have a lot to get to and not so much time to get to it. So without much further ado, we're going to bring on a very special guest. She is a personal friend of mine. She works in criminal and family law. She graduated from undergrad Chico State and did law school at UOP, and she is out there fighting the good fight. So let's please welcome my good friend Michelle Trigger.
Hello, Michelle. How are you today?
I am doing well. I am surprised to find that I am such a good friend. Thank you, Henry. I think you're a good friend.
Well, we're in a fantasy football group text that goes all day, every day. So we're connected at the hip.
That's true. That time that you had to hire me, it's just been bliss ever since. I'm just
I was just about to say, it's kind of fitting to see that here's my great friend, my attorney, Michelle, who's working
on my cases. So you can beat me in fantasy football and just in case you get in legal trouble.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have Michelle here, and tell us a little bit about what you do, what kind of the most common cases that you have, and a little bit about yourself.
So I am out here in California, so I'm based out of Sacramento. My office is in Sacramento. I pretty much practice in Sacramento area. That can include Placer County, Bay Area counties, a little bit of El Dorado, and a little more northern than that. Anything from traffic tickets to major felonies, I do tend to do mostly felonies. So that's going to be your robberies, your burglaries, your homicides, your gang offenses, firearm offenses, that type of thing. As far as family law goes, which is sort of a secondary area of mine, but I do perform family law as well these days, it's going to be restraining orders, divorce, child custody, support issues. I would say the most popular case, if you will, out of Sacramento is typically going to be more on the criminal side. We get, unfortunately, a lot of violence out here in this part.
All right. I have to, before we dig in deep, I have to ask it's probably the most annoying question to you and maybe the most common, but as a criminal lawyer, do you ever refuse cases, and what kind of cases would you refuse?
So most attorneys in my field do have a type of case they will refuse. Almost everyone's type of case is child molest. My type of case is animal cruelty. I don't love child abusers, to be clear. I just hate animal abusers more. So I cannot do animal abuse cases, animal cruelty cases. I was appointed one time, and it's the only time my career that I could actually feel enough of a bias towards the person that I didn't think that it was healthy for me to take those types of cases, because I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing and assisting people regardless of the facts of their case. But I could not look at those pictures and even want, I would not even want to talk to the person on the phone. So that's the only type of case. If you call me, I'm just going to refer you out.
Is it like a thing of you believe everyone deserves a fair trial and representation as it states in our Constitution?
The deal? That would be part of it. I would say it's probably my secondary reason for being a defense attorney. I do think everyone's entitled and deserves sort of the constitutional protection. I do think that's very important. It keeps checks and balances on the government, which is literally what our country was built upon, right? And when we hear about stories from other countries that shock our conscience about how, you know, they're basically just going to be found guilty immediately. I mean, we even hear if you're going to, you know, vacation even somewhere as close to us as Mexico, you know, you're gonna have to pay off an officer if you get pulled over. It is just striking how different other countries are. And the reason ours is unique is because we actually enforce our justice system when it's uncomfortable. So if the government does something wrong, we hold them accountable so that they don't do things wrong as often, and it protects all of us. The more important reason is that no one's perfect. And when people make mistakes, which we all do, some are more egregious than others. Anyone who's ever made a major mistake will tell you that they feel very alone. Most people abandon them, whether it's friends, family, employer, as someone like me who truly believes that everybody deserves to have someone in their corner, even if they've made a really bad decision.
I'm gonna hop in on this. Now we're on this is how it works here at Rude Dude. So we just kind of bounce off the wall. Yeah. We just kind of bounce off the wall like bouncing balls. So deal with us. I got to take my hat off to you because I don't know if I have internally like the right substance to look at somebody that I know is guilty and go in there and be like, hey, I'm gonna try to make sure that you're not. Now I don't say that you're doing that. Are you like trying to just kind of like, you know, make it a little bit easier or how does that work? Like, does that tear at you a little bit if you know someone's completely guilty, but you got to stand up there and try to give them the best fair shake as you can, as Henry said?
No, and this is the most common question. I wouldn't say that it's an unfair question because we just feel like we get asked a lot, but I think it's a really important question to answer.
I'm sorry for asking.
Statistically, very few cases actually go to trial. And so the perception is that if you do defense work, you know, and you know someone's guilty and, you know, your point is to try to get them off. And that's usually not what's going on. Usually, if you look at all of the cases, you're talking, I believe the statistic is about 2% of cases are actually going to go to trial, where you are actively asking for a jury to acquit your client. And by the way, you're not even asking for them to find your client innocent. You're just saying that the government has not reached its burden of beyond a reasonable doubt such they can be guilty. I feel usually very good about that if it reaches that point, because it's not at that point because me or my client just wants to get them off, so to speak. I'll give you one example. So I had a case a number of years ago where my client, here in California, we have something called three strikes. So the spirit of the three strikes law was always supposed to be at some point, if somebody has basically committed their life to crime, they're consistently engaging in pretty serious crimes, because it's not just any crime that qualifies, right? You're talking about violent crimes, murder, rape, some versions of assault. If you do that
robbery.
Yeah, exactly. If you do that three times, at some point, you know, you're done. And that feels fair, right? I mean, how many times do you have to commit a seriously violent act before we just say you can't come back and continue doing it? But what ended up happening is that certain crimes are made strikes that you would be shocked are strikes. So here would be an example. So in California, we have something called criminal threats. So if I lose to Henry in fantasy football, Which, by the way, I did not this week. I beat him by less than
a point. Waiting for that. I was waiting
for
that.
There we go, dude.
Jake Moody almost brought me to back from the dead, dude.
Gosh, I've never loved garbage time more in my life. And I bet
garbage time touchdown against my defense brought me back down less than half a point below her.
That's what I'm talking about, Michelle. Give it to him.
So if I text Henry and I actually have sort of the ability to carry out on it, and I say, you know, look, I'm going to fly out there to West Virginia and I'm going to come kick your ass in person. And I'm going to make sure that I do a really good job. And I give just a little bit enough detail. It's actually a felony strike, right? So if you communicate a threat writing or verbally, and it is specific enough and it's received seriously, is a strike. And so not condoning threats, but you can imagine that's not the same as an armed robbery. That's not the same as a rape. And we know it's not the same because that very same crime can also be charged as a misdemeanor. So here in California, you do something really stupid because you get in a bar fight, and that could be a felony strike, or it could be a misdemeanor with some community service with no distinguishment other than whatever the prosecutor feels like charging. So what often happens is my clients are overcharged. So the case I'm referencing, I had a guy who received two strikes within the same case, because you can receive two strikes in the same case, 26 years ago. He was homeless, and he and his partner at the time found an unlocked vacation home in the middle of winter. They went inside, they slept in it. They didn't touch a thing except that he went to the bathroom and he flushed the toilet. And the prosecutor elected to charge that as a third strike, because it was, they were considering it a burglary because there was an entry into the home. Of course, my argument was they didn't take anything. Theft of toilet water is actually theft. And so they were elected.
No.
And so, I'm curious. And so I don't care how much toilet water my man took. I will sit there in front of a jury and I will have all of the celebrations afterwards if, you know, we walk him, and that
God dang right. Jesus.
So that's usually the trial stories. More often than not, you know what I'm doing all day, every day? I'm trying to make somebody's resolution fair, right? Don't lock away lock someone away, throw away the key, because maybe their youth explains something. Maybe their substance abuse explains something. You know, we're not supposed to just be punitive. We're supposed to be aimed at rehabilitation. I help them find programs. I try to negotiate, you know, alternatives other than prison. So that's usually what my job is. Pretty much all day I'm in court or I'm in my office trying to just make things a little bit easier for people. And I assure you, it's very, very rare that just, you know, just dead to rights, guilty people are walking free.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So this is actually a perfect segue into my first topic here. We've talked a lot, you and I, about a lot of your clients have mental health issues and substance abuse issues, and you seem to be passionate about getting people the help they deserve, which is kind of exactly what you were just talking about, as opposed to being punitive and get people into rehab. And you also mentioned to me that you feel like there are there's some crimes that qualify for what is it, diversion, and some that don't, that are very strange. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So we were just talking about how we're trying to find resolutions for people in their cases that might actually help, right? So one of the things we have out here and in many states, probably all states actually, is something called diversion. So for people who don't know what diversion is, it means in lieu of a jail or a prison commitment. So as opposed to just getting a conviction and serving time, diversion is a mechanism usually by statute that you are able to do classes, you're able to do treatment, you're able to do rehabilitation. And it's usually for a substantial period of time, 1 to 2 years. It can be more than that depending on circumstance. But if you do it, you complete it, you're successful, you earn yourself a dismissal. And the idea behind diversion is that if you if you're committed enough to do diversion for 1 or 2 years, and it's either going to be drug diversion generally or mental health diversion. So for example, with drug diversion, if you stay sober and you're doing all of your classes at the end of a year or two, you know, that's pretty indicative that you're serious about change and you're probably not going to be reoffending if that was the underlying issue. So you earned yourself a dismissal. Mental health issues is another one. Many, many people are engaged in criminal activity, not because they enjoy committing crimes, but because they suffer from a mental health issue. Often it's undiagnosed. We are in a new era where it's okay, if not very acceptable, to have mental health issues. It has not always been like that. So we have an entire generation, if not multiple generations of people, where this was a huge stigma. And so, you know, they're out, we'll say, committing a crime, but if you really look at the crime, you can tell even from just a quick review of a report, you know, this is somebody with mental health issues. You know, they came in, they took something and walked out because maybe they're not even all there. They don't even understand in some extreme cases that they've stolen something, or if they have one of the unfortunately common mental health issues that we deal with is bipolar. So when people are suffering a manic episode, it is literally a Jekyll and Hyde thing. And I have many clients, one in particular is one of my favorites, where he's a very smart guy. You feel like he wouldn't hurt a fly. He's been in my office a million times and is just the nicest guy. When the switch would flip, if you will, it was absolute terror. Well, turns out that he has been, you know, dealing with undiagnosed bipolar disorder. So upon getting him proper medication, he's himself all the time, right? Yeah. So yeah. If we're able to get him medication and treatment, and he does that for a year or two, and there's no episodes, you know, we've fixed or maybe wholly addressed, if you know, the issue. And so now there's not going to be a reoffense. So we try to do diversion to fix it so that people don't do more crimes in the future. And that, of course, serves all of us, and it serves their children, it serves their relationships. I have a bone to pick with a lot of the rules about diversion. One of the bones I have to pick is, and you know, not to get political because I promise I won't, but there's been a great deal of lobbying surrounding DUIs, right? And this happened years and years and years ago where Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which do wonderful work, I want to be clear, but they did a huge amount of lobbying and it resulted in a very, very strict DUI laws. And one of those is that DUI is pretty much the only thing outside of very serious felonies that is not eligible for diversion. So if I have a guy that stabbed someone, I can get him diversion potentially. If I have a 50-year-old mom who's going through a divorce and she's never had a traffic ticket, she got a first-time DUI, she's ineligible for diversion. And so that is remarkable to me because I think most people who have ever dealt with any substance issues would agree that it starts with alcohol. I don't really believe in the gateway, so to speak, but most of the time, if somebody is prone to substance issues, they're probably trying alcohol first, right? They're not going to their first high school party and doing heroin or something. So if you could actually get in on the first sign of a substance abuse issue, I don't know why we would not want to do that. And a DUI is usually indicative, unless it's a pretty isolated incident. I mean, it's at least an indication that somebody might be struggling with a substance abuse issue at that point in their life. Right. And so the fact don't want to offer diversion to that person, I have a bone to pick with that. The second one is when you actually throw someone into drug diversion, I don't think you do it in a way that actually understands addiction. They pretty much expect cold turkey, which if you're truly addicted to alcohol, it's actually dangerous to just cold turkey stop without medical intervention. And for other drugs, asking a true addict to just completely stop cold turkey is extremely difficult. I mean, the withdrawals, at one point in my life, I actually worked in a jail. I don't think I've ever seen someone suffer as badly as somebody who gets arrested, can't post bail, and they're addicted to something. Mm-hmm. So it kind of sets them up.
Heroin addicts shitting themselves for a week straight.
Yep.
So that's exactly it. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's for people that don't know, it's literally that. It's awful. And so they don't really have an understanding that you can't just, I mean, I will have a client get into diversion and man, if they don't report to probation a week later clean, you know, that's, they could potentially be violated. And it's very, very difficult to explain to people who don't understand. I'm not sure my client can be clean in a week. He's committed to be clean, but especially if I can't find him a bed or I can't get him immediately, like today on, you know, gabapentin or something, he's not going to be healthy and testing clean. In Henry's very correct words, he might be shitting himself in court, in fact.
So. Yeah, yeah.
So I do think that it is, and there could be more understanding with diversion, but I do appreciate, I know California is a little bit liberal, but in this situation, it's wonderful because we are one of the states that actually is expanding our diversion program. So I do appreciate that at least.
Yeah, I think the, you know, it's odd with the DUI thing, like, and it's, now that you mention it, it's super true, right? Like it's jail time or community service. Like there's no go to rehab. There's no anything like that. And you're 100% correct because ready, like I got my first DUI at 19, right? And that would have been, you know, in a different world, you know, a red flag for somebody, but, you know, no, nothing was offered. It was jail, you know, community service. And then the second DUI comes and I'm blowing like a 2.9 passed out in a gas station. Still nothing, right? It's still the same outcome. Now, could that have been stopped if we had this new diversion, you know, route that you're mentioning? Maybe. I mean, I don't know the outcome of that, but those are the red flags, right? And it is kind of sad that we still haven't come around to that. I know that wasn't a question, but I just wanted to comment on it because it's kind of interesting that we still treat it that way.
Yeah, usually, and so you would be a good example. You know as well as anybody, hey, you know, I'm a kid at that point. Hey guys, there's a red flag here. There's a second red flag here. The only quote unquote treatment is in most counties, you'll go do what we call an alcohol education class. It is not treatment based. It basically makes you feel like garbage. Hey, this is why you shouldn't drink and drive. Okay, well, if it was easy as telling an addict, you really shouldn't do drugs, they're real bad for you, I don't think that we would have.
Yeah.
Not that simple.
Good thing you bought me a book to tell me that drugs and alcohol are bad. I mean, come
actually,
on.
Actually, you're so right because I remember I had to do that class before and they literally just show you like videos of like people killing people and drunk driving.
Yeah, dude.
You're like, you, this is you. You fucking suck. Look at you. This is what you could have done.
I remember going to the Brining Institute up there at the Bank of America up there on fucking Hazel and Madison, dude. And I remember watching the videos, yeah, of drunk driving accidents and people crying and then mad and all that
you
stuff.
Fucking scum bucket.
That's exactly what I mean. You're like, okay. And then if you're an addict, you look at the clock and go, 5 more minutes and I'm going to go grab a beer to get over the red video that I just had to watch.
Exactly.
And if you're top tier alcohol addict, you may have had one or two before you went in. So something that I kind of heard you say and that I tell all my friends and you can confirm this is that like it's really hard. So if you have a 2-year diversion program and you stay clean, like it's hard, it's a lot of work. A lot of my friends that are in recovery and doing well, they worry about their case and what's going on with them. But I say, listen, if you just do what they ask you to do, the judge will love you because they are so used to people not doing a fucking thing. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to court and I'm sitting there waiting for my turn because you know 30 people go ahead of you. And they go, Mr. Smith, I see you didn't sign up for parent classes. You don't have your AA sign-in sheet. You didn't. You're remanded to custody. And they do that over and over and over. And then you get up there and you go, oh, Mr. Sheridan, I see you've gone to 12 AA meetings. You have 16 of your anger management classes. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for doing this. I'm glad you're doing very well. Come on back. We'll see you next time. So I always try to tell people, listen, don't sweat it. Just do what they ask. Do what they've asked of you, and you'll be fine, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you're correct. They hear so many excuses that when somebody does something right, they practically throw you a parade. Because most of the judges, you know, they want you to do well, right? You're not at a sentencing stage. They don't care about your underlying crime. You know, they're not there to be harsh on you. They're just there to make sure that you are doing what you promised to do. And so I think what you're referencing, for example, is like batterer's treatment program. So if you have a domestic violence case, no matter how minor, by statute, usually you have to take classes. It's 52 weeks. So it's a long class. I mean, if you go to college, you don't even take a 52-week class. They're an hour a week, and you can't stack them, right? So you can't do a couple in a week even. So every single week for a year, you're doing a class. So it is difficult. So they basically see most people failing, at least not doing very well. And they'll give second, third chances. At some point, they may kick you. But they are very impressed if you actually do it. And so
they
love it.
It's pretty quick. Like, you can only miss three in like the whole year. And I have to shout out the great Claudia Diaz. I don't know if you ever heard of her. She taught my batterer's treatment program, and she would always go, "Batterer's treatment? What the fuck is that? You guys making fucking cakes? I don't like that fucking word."
I agree with her, and I mentioned her on the podcast. I hate, and you know, I got to tell you, I have resorted to calling it BTP just because the second my clients hear it, because again, this is going on the spectrum. You can catch a domestic violence case and never touch somebody. I had a guy who was the nicest guy ever.
Criminal threats and terroristic threats, like you said.
And his wife was like, well, to use his word, a complete nag, and just would constantly just harass him. And she was throwing stuff at him, and he took a glass of water and he threw it on her. He did not throw the glass, he threw water. Man, when I had to explain to him he was going to do 52 weeks of batterer's treatment program, he's like, I didn't beat my wife. Doesn't matter, right? You're just going to have to do it. And again, you know, it's not a one size fits all. And gosh, I wish they would change the name because it makes you feel like a wife beater. No offense to wife beaters, but I really wish that they would call it like, you know, I don't know. I don't even like anger management necessarily, but I do think they could be more careful. They don't need to call it batterer's treatment, but they do.
Yeah. I mean, I was in a similar situation and got the same kind of classes. I did want to ask you, you do teach a class and you advocate for fathers. Do you you don't teach the batterer's treatment class, do you? Or what is the class that you do?
So the classes that I do are, one is a legal document workshop. And so it is actually a class that I designed with one of the managers there, because in family court, you're not entitled to the appointment of attorneys as the way you are in criminal court. And I think that can be very sad because arguably your stakes are higher in family court. I don't have children. However, the thought of, you know, going to misdemeanor court and the worst that I can do would be 1 year in jail if I'm maxed out at sentencing, to me would be less severe than going to family court and possibly losing my child, right? And so the stakes are very high in family court. And if you can't afford an attorney, I'm not one to say that you're just going to lose. I don't think that's true, but you are not gonna fare as well in family court by yourself. So one of the reasons is because, you know, I'd like to think that they don't send me to school for the length of time that they did, because everybody can do my job, right? Forms just by themselves can be very complicated. If you do a divorce out here in California, from start to finish, you're talking upwards of 12 different legal forms. You know, if you're doing a custody modification and you have to initiate a paternity case, it's very similar. And so I had a lot of fathers coming through the center who, I mean, they can barely read and write at times. and you're asking them to do legal forms. And if they do them wrong, in a particularly harsh circumstance, you know, they can be defaulted, or a judge can decline to read their response, or they can exclude their evidence because they didn't file it correctly. So I started a class where we would just show dads who were going through litigation how to do their forms. And then most of the time I check them, or I used to, we do most of them by Zoom now. And so I'll email the forms. I just used to bring stacks of forms. And then that way, when they leave, you know, at least we know their forms are correct. The other class that we do is called Daddy's Here. And it actually does qualify for anger management classes. So we call it, it's an anger management parenting class hybrid, except that it focuses, and anybody's welcome, but it is called Daddy's Here for a reason, because we do try to focus on the unique challenges of dads. And, you know, something in the legal system that I observed is that dads kind of get the shaft sometimes because dads are not as warm and fuzzy as moms. So if you have an intact household, you know, mom is going to kiss your knee and dad's going to tell you to stop crying, right? Well, except if you go to family court, that starts to sound from, you know, ex-wife, I'm the caretaker and the nurturer and dad's abusive, right? My kid fell and he refused to get a medical treatment. And I know that sounds extreme, but I see it all the time where dad's like, what? Or gosh, I had one where, you know, dad didn't want to put the kid into ballet. Dad wanted to put the kid into taekwondo. And all of a sudden, you know, my client is being called, you know, a homophobe. Just extremely stupid type of banter. And so, and I won't even repeat what he said, but he ticked the judge off because he was like, he didn't know what a homophobe was. He's like, no, I'm not saying that my, you know, that my kid's gay. As it was bad, the judge is open. I'm kind of laughing. And I'm like, sometimes dads just, they're a little bit more blunt, or they put things a little differently, or they're not as warm and fuzzy as mom. So we really try to explain some of those things so that they come across better in court. We also provide them a safe space for them to kind of vent to each other about these challenges. And then also we try to help them litigate unique challenges, such as if they work full time and, you know, mom was a homemaker, as opposed to being, you know, told, well, you don't have the availability to care for your children. We help them craft schedules that, you know, work around work schedules. Or we try to help set them up with opportunities where maybe they don't have to work the standard 9-to-5. Pretty much any type of supportive resource so that these guys can be an equal parent, because that's important. And so we do that. I do that class once a month over at the center. It's been pretty successful, and we enjoy doing it.
Nice.
That is, I just want to say that's really, really cool. I think it's awesome that you do that. My teacher, Claudia Diaz, would remind us all the time, like, especially when people were being like snippy with her or something, she'd be like, I'm a fucking lawyer. I could go make $400 an hour. You think I do this for fun? You think I do this to make money? I don't give a shit about your little. So because she was there because she wanted to help, which sounds like the same, you know, your same thing. And I do think it's tough. Like, people don't have resources, and I forgot about that, how you're not appointed a lawyer for family court. That's so tough because a lot of people don't have the money for that. So people like you doing things like that for people who need the help is really cool. And I have to say, as a graduate of that class, it was really helpful to me. Like, there are two people in my life that I learned the most from, and one of them's Randall Brown and the other one's Claudia Diaz. And she was, she just taught me so much, man. Like, she always said, and it wasn't her quote, but she told me it. And so it's her quote, but she said, between action and reaction is a moment. And in that moment is choice. And that was like one of the big things. And then also people always be, yeah, my baby mom. And she'd be like, you picked her. She's like, did you know her middle name before you fucked her? And she also wouldn't let anybody objectify anyone, especially women. She'd be like, yeah, and people be like, yeah, I was hanging out with this chick. A chicken? You were hanging out with a chicken?
Dude.
But she had so many, like, she was a savage. Rest in peace.
I would get she had so much of Claudia, I tell you. Because
you would, yeah.
That made me laugh she because had, I say a very similar thing to my men, my dads, and they say baby mama, and I don't mind the term baby mama. I won't correct them on that, but if they start to complain and say things like she's crazy, and I was like, well, yeah, but you know, you did put your penis in there, so it was good enough. Right. And so, you know, like if you're just here to complain that you picked the crazy one, like that's not what my class is about. Like we're gonna, help you through it, but you did have sex with her, and so maybe next time be a little bit more selective.
Well, hey, I have a burning question. Henry knows what I'm going to ask here. You sent a bunch of clips, and I see that you've been on the news a bunch. For us Californians out here, we all know about the outstanding homeless crisis here, and I saw something about the city of Sacramento against the DA and how the city of Sacramento isn't doing something. Is there an end in sight to this homeless situation out here? Like, is the city doing anything? Do you have any insight on that? Because it seems like nothing's getting solved. And since you're in there and in the trenches, and it just seems to be getting worse out here, I just wanted to know.
I am. I have to step over a homeless man to get into my office most days. Yeah, and we pay him actively not to shit in our alley. So it is constantly reminding me of the crisis.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, dude. Just a side tangent. I was out. I went to like a TJ Maxx the other day, dude. And I'm walking with my wife, and dude, there is a human turd on the sidewalk. And I'm like, dude, I live in a third world country. Like, what is happening? So yeah, please continue. Sorry, it's just incredible.
No, it's so. I won't go too far back, but anybody who is not in Sacramento, just to kind of give you an idea, downtown has gotten progressively worse, and it has been very noticeable in about the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be some amount of homelessness, of course, in a city, especially in California. We have nice weather. You won't actually die if you sleep outside. But they passed a number of policies here in Sacramento locally, that were supposed to be sensitive, to the plight of homelessness, but really what they've done is they've worsened the problem exponentially. So for example, for quite some time, you could not ask a homeless person to move their tent. Did not matter where it was, as long as it wasn't in the middle of the street. So this isn't going on anymore, but for example, I live downtown and I literally had, a homeless person set up his tent like on my sidewalk. And, I'm a single female who would prefer not to have, a homeless man living in a tent outside of my door. At that point, it's kind of a safety issue. And downtown, it's the same thing with clients. We would have, homeless people trying to sneak in behind our clients, and then they would, go into the bathrooms and destroy our bathrooms. So they've been a little bit better recently. I'm not going to say it is completely attributed to what's going on between the DA and the city, but what's going on is that the DA kind of got fed up, and most of us feel the same way, with the lack of action on the city's part. And anytime it felt like the district attorney was trying to, help, usually by way of prosecution, because that's really the only thing that they can do, they were being labeled as insensitive. And that wasn't really fair, because a lot of times, the arrests and the prosecutions, it's like, well, what else do you want us to do? If somebody's out here, I shouldn't laugh, but there was another time a little ways back where we had a tent kind of kitty corner to the courthouse, and it was the prostitution tent. It was very obvious that there was prostitution going on in this tent. And so based on the noises and the number of men frequenting the tent, it could not have been more obvious. And wow. then the cops are like, we're not going to bother, because they're like, we go out here, we can't touch the tent. You know, we can't, we submit our reports. They're, you know, we're not, they don't go and get prosecuted. So who cares? What? So the DA like basically lodged a lawsuit and said, I'm going to sue personally, you know, the city, because if the city is, you know, not taking care of this, taking care of the situation, it's a public safety issue. And so it's a very sort of creative approach. I'm not sure it's actually going to be successful, but knowing the district attorney, I don't even think that he necessarily cares if the lawsuit itself is successful. I think it's more about doing it and that it was on the news and that people are talking about it. It's being written up. It's calling for action. It's to some extent embarrassing the city and saying, look, this is not, you know, an us issue. It's a city issue. So that's what's been going on, but it is somewhat entertaining watching these two, both the mayor, who's Steinberg out here, and our DA, Tin Ho, publicly going at it. And I don't know how it'll end up, but it is getting a little bit better down here, I think, because they are changing some of those policies now.
Okay. Well, so you're telling me there's a little bit of hope. I'll take that.
Not to get too political, but I feel like part of the problem is we're asking basically police to be social workers, and it's not like these are people, like you were talking about, with mental health issues and stuff and addiction issues. And I don't know, I don't know what the solution is, but they're going about it all wrong, in my opinion. But I did want to switch to one thing, because I know a lot of our listeners have experienced it and gone through it. You mentioned about drug court, and I wanted something in one of the links you sent, or the dissertation that you sent me by email. You were talking about a drug court, and one of the things for me as a, and I have not done it. A lot of my friends have done it, and it almost seems like a trap. It seems like they want them to fail, because like you have to do so many things and you have to go so often, and they're like, why aren't you employed? Why aren't you employed? Well, I can't, nobody wants to hire me. I've worked with people who are in drug court, and every 2 days, they got to freaking go back and do something else and like go see their, and like, It's frustrating to me, and I haven't even experienced it. Just knowing people who have done it, that like it really seems like it's set up for failure, because it's like you have to work 40 hours a week, but you also have to report here 3 times a week during the daytime, during business hours. Like, there's so many things about it that seem like a trap, and I just wanted to get your opinion on that.
Yes, and I don't think trap is an unfair word. I don't think I would like assign necessarily maliciousness to a judge or a prosecutor, but I do think that they need to be a little bit more honest about it, because in my experience, yes, I've even been in situations where I will advocate for drug court and kind of get the off the record, okay, yeah, I'll give him drug court because I know he's going to fail. And if he fails, then here's going to be the suspended sentence, and it's something really harsh. I'm not saying that prosecutor necessarily hopes for failure, but the chuckle seems to suggest that they don't have much confidence and that they know that the system is going to set them up for failure, and they will inevitably fail, right? So actually, something that you just brought up is relevant to this question. So for example, homelessness. Many, many homeless people have mental health issues and or drug issues. If you want to do either of those diversion programs, but let's just talk about drug court, you have to be a resident of the county that your case is in. So if you're in Sacramento, for example, and you're homeless and you get arrested for a drug-related crime, and we're able to try and negotiate drug court for you, you cannot do drug court because you don't have a residence in Sacramento. Even if you were to find a bed in Roosevelt, they would say no, because one, it's not in Sacramento, and two, it's not stable. That's a problem, because now you have a whole host of people, arguably the people who need drug court the most, who aren't eligible from the onset. And you also can be order things like to maintain employment. Employment's pretty much necessary if you're going to pay for everything that's associated with drug court. Here's what I mean by that. Aside from the travel costs, for example, in drug court, if they tell you you have to do certain methods of treatment, you have to do certain methods of treatment. So, for example, if they say, we think that you need to do an outpatient program, come back in 30 days with proof of enrollment in your outpatient program, you better hope you have insurance and you better hope it covers outpatient programs. Because if not, you're now going in potentially, I mean, and I understand there's functional addicts, but let's be honest, most of the people in the throes of addiction are not doing very well financially. So they're barely getting up. They're barely even surviving. They may not have even a stable residence. And now they have to go and they have to locate and pay for a private outpatient, you know, program. Or sometimes they'll say,
which is upwards of $30,000 plus if you don't have.
Yes. And counseling is another one. Counseling is a wonderful resource. And in theory, when you're advocating, they say, you know, they should do counseling. I agree. We should all do counseling. Have you looked up the prices of private counseling lately? Because, you know, they're very expensive. And how do you get insurance? You get a job. How do you get a job? Not be addicted to drugs all the time. How do I get away from my addiction to drugs? Well, we want you to do the counseling you can't afford. It's a really awful, unrestricted cycle.
Yes, you can have a job. What's your home address? I don't have one. What's your bank account? I don't have one.
Dude, it just sounds like it's completely fucked. I mean, and I know that's a very brash way and, you know, unintelligible way to say it, but I mean, it's just that's not it. That's not the way, because it's just that's not feasible. How are we, let alone somebody who's homeless? You can't say, I mean, how are they going to get a job? What are they going to do? They have no place. If they have no place of residence, where are they going to go get clean? Where are they getting these clothes? Where are they doing all these things? And then you want to give them these services. Well, dude, I can barely afford counseling. I mean, I live in California, bro. It's expensive as fuck out here. So like, you know, there's no way that's achievable. So it sounds like there's a lot more work ahead than I even fully understood. Cause there's no way that's ever going to be successful in that paradigm.
Nope. And you know, to touch on both of your points, and by the way, Cameron, I've looked for a much better word to describe that system than fucked. I've not yet found one, but I'll let you know if I do.
Well, good. Thank you. I'm glad you agreed. For me, I'm a simple mind. I'm a simple man, man. Just my alcoholic brain be like, man, this is fucked up, dude.
Yeah. And Henry brought up, for example, the amount of commitment that drug court would take. That alone, again, it's unrealistic and it sets somebody up, because from the onset, you're dealing with somebody with addiction. We talked about how challenging it is to just go cold turkey anyway, how challenging it is to get resources. But also, I think it would be very, very unique to talk to an addict that doesn't suffer a relapse ever, particularly the first time that they try. And so they're trying to achieve sobriety. And you're saying, you know, no relapses. And I'm not saying that they never give you a second chance, but they don't give you many, and they're certainly not obligated to do so. And so you have to commit to not only no relapses, which is very sad to me, because of course you have the intention of staying clean. It's just not realistic to say, I know for sure I'm going to sign documents that promise you complete sobriety for a year or two. But probably should say, what I promise you is I'm going to try. And then, you know, if you miss an appointment, if you go to drug test, for example, and you're late, you miss your test, it's considered to be a dirty test. If you're homeless, for example, I'm sure you probably don't have a car, so you better hope that your tent's next to probation and it has a fake address that you've given SAC, so they think you have an address. I mean, it becomes very difficult to make sure that you're at your appointments, you're doing your drug tests. If you go in to get a job, you have to tell them, well, by the way, I have drug court every Wednesday at, you know, 8:30 in the morning, so I can't do that. Or, you know, by the way, drug testing. I have to do counseling once a week. And so, by the way, new employer, I have counseling once a week. I have drug court once a week. You know, I need to go and I'm actually randomly drug testing, so I don't even know when my drug test is. So you have to be okay with me leaving, you know, work at some point early so I can go do my drug test. You know, the list goes on and on, but
it just keeps getting worse.
I know.
And that's kind of my problem, is like the rigidity of it. It's like, it's not, hey, we'll work with you, we'll work around your schedule. We understand that employers don't like you randomly leaving all the fucking time, you know, but we want you to have a job. Like, it's so rigid. And it does seem like what you said, it's kind of the snicker, like, yeah, you can have drug court. Good luck, you know. And that's what's kind of frustrating to me about that particular situation, because you would think if the true goal was like rehabilitation and success, that there would be like a little bit more moving parts in it that are like, okay, we understand that that's difficult. And like, I know you also have to have a firm hand, and there's also possibilities for people to cheat the tests and stuff if they're given whatever, but it's like, man, do we really want to help? Or is it just like, the carrot dangling that you can never get, and we're going to remand you right back to custody as soon as you screw up, you know?
I think, honestly, and it's sad, and I do have many clients who are successful in drug court, but I'll tell you something. Usually the successful clients are the ones that don't really have a drug issue. If I have a client who he got pulled over because he went to the club and he has some cocaine on him, and I get him drug court, he's like, okay, he probably is working in an office somewhere. He's fine. He has a residence. He has a car. You know, maybe he goes and he parties a little bit too much here and there, but he's not actually actively in addiction. So he just shows up. He doesn't have a problem, you know, testing clean for a year. That's who's going to be successful in drug court. But guess what? That's not really who drug court is set up for. Drug court, you don't need to just bring in a bunch of people who say, oh, I got caught, but, you know, I'm fine being able to pay for these things because I have a job. I'm fine not using drugs because, you know, I do them once in a while, but I'm not addicted to them. And so they show up for a year and, you know, they don't have an issue with it. And then those people are the shiny examples. And the real addicts are sitting in the back, and they know, you know, the difference when you see people, and you have the guy that rode two buses to get over there, and he has to explain to the court why he's going to have another violation because, you know, his buddy that the promised to ride, you know, couldn't. So that's what ends up being extra sad to me, is that they watch people who don't really have drug issues get the certificate and look, drug court works. And then the people that really need it are usually the ones that are going to be failing out of it.
I feel like there'd be like some sort of like, you know, sliding scale, right? Like based on like past criminal offenses, or like, hey, like this person's homeless. Like, you know, like I know that's hard to put into a legal framework, right? Because it's like, oh, okay, well, hey, this guy's worse, so he gets package A of this prescription, and this guy's just some rich guy who got caught with a fucking eight ball, so we'll give him package B. But for me, from what I can hear, it sounds like that might be the only option, right? Like can we kind of work a little bit? Can we wiggle it a tad for certain circumstantial cases? Like, because coming from somebody who is a recovering alcoholic and was a real alcoholic, right? Like drank every day, all day. Dude, like you don't know if you're coming or going in those first like 30 days, 60 days when you're coming out trying to get sober. And I relapsed in the first 60 days of when I first attempted to actually get sober. You know what I mean? And if I was involved in one of those cases, right, I would be considered a failure. And you know, that's not true, right? Because I'm working towards 7 years of sobriety now. But in the eyes of the law, yeah, there you go. Congratulations, you failed, you know, and that just doesn't seem right to me, man. Like this episode's very informative, and it's also incredibly fucking disheartening, dude. I'm like over here like sad and shit, and like just upset. And now I'm mad. I want to go burn down the Capitol. I mean, what's going on, dude?
Terroristic threats. That's a strike.
I am going to jail, dude. Oh, fuck. Dude, it's a strike.
we'll edit that out. Don't worry about it. Newsom, leave me alone, dude.
Well, you know, it's both disheartening and it should trigger some anger, because that does tend to be the best thing when maybe you're asked next time to go to a voting booth, because we are occasionally seeing bills come up that are going to be more flexible with drug crimes, more flexible with mental health crimes. And sometimes they're marketed as, you know, this is going easy on crime. And so often we will see what could actually make a meaningful change. And people go in not knowing these issues, and all they think, all they see is, oh, we're going to let, you know, all of these people have a free pass. And if they really become informed, that tends to mean they may walk in there and go, no, you know, I've heard some of these issues. I don't think that this bill is because we're trying to, you know, make life easier for criminals. I actually know about this, and right now there's a lot of challenges, or I don't think that that crime should be a strike. We're not going easy. It's just, I don't think someone should do life in prison because, you know, they told somebody they're going to burn down the Capitol. I don't know. So,
FBI man's at my door, dude. I got to get out of here.
I'm just kidding. But that's why it's important for me to kind of get it out there, because usually when I have an opportunity to talk to people, you know, then they see it differently, and then maybe they talk about it differently, maybe they vote about it differently, or someday if they're on my jury, maybe they think about it differently as well. So I think that that's probably the appropriate reaction. It's the reaction I have all day. That's why, you know, I'm probably frustrated all the time.
All right. Well, I've been sitting here thinking about this, and I don't even know how to approach it. But I lost a very good friend of mine, and you lost your soulmate, our buddy JC. We gotta talk about it. And one thing where I maybe wanted to start was you and I were texting the other night, and we talked about how it was. You mentioned how it's difficult to love an addict. So we also do have a lot of people that listen who are family and friends of addicts. So can you maybe talk about that a little bit?
I can. So so JC, as Henry mentioned, was a longtime friend of Henry. That's how Henry and I met. So JC and I were together for about 9 years. And so JC passed away at 33. We lost him in 2021. And he's an interesting example. And he's one that I think his story is important, because when he was in college, he went away to college. He actually went to Chico State as well. And what I would say, like most people who go to college, maybe they go to a party or two while they're in college, right? And that is the first time where somebody gave him the drug we know as OxyContin. And this was way before people had any understanding and appreciation of the opiate epidemic. And so this was still when they were considered not addictive. They were, you know, opiates were being used as party drugs, particularly Oxy. And the way he used to describe it, and I think that he would be very okay with me kind of just retelling it the way that he did, because eventually he actually would speak on this even himself at high schools and things of that nature. So he did Oxy. He actually didn't even really know what it was. And when he woke up having what I presume was used enough of it to have this reaction, he basically was having withdrawals, and he just immediately started using the Oxy. And he was a standout, you know, in high school. So he, you know, honor roll, he was his class president. He was prom king. Gosh, you still would bring that up even at 30 years old. He was, you know, star football player, the whole thing.
Certified pretty boy.
Hilarious.
Hey.
Certified pretty boy, sure.
I'm 36, and I still talk about being homecoming king in high school. All right, so hey, don't judge me. All right,
we flashed early. We peaked in high school.
You know, I don't blame you guys. I may or may not still have my homecoming queen crown. So,
yeah, see, hard to let go.
But I mention it because he's also very smart. I absolutely love JC because he was hilarious and he's smart. So I bring that up because addiction does not seem to discriminate. You can be pretty, you can be smart, you can be successful, you can have the entire world, right? And mm-hmm. he in college. And so it's very hard to fault a kid. I mean, he was 18 years old going to college, becomes addicted to OxyContin. And then basically what happened is him and a couple other college students one night were coming back from a music festival. They used some drugs and one of them did not wake up. JC was the one that had originally brought the drugs. And as a result, thank you to the charging decisions that we talked about a little bit today, he was charged with a felony. And so at least here in California, we have what we call a straight felony, meaning it can never be dropped down to a misdemeanor or anything, that if you furnish drugs to someone, not sell them, you know, just furnish. So whoever handed you the drug, which has to be somebody, unless you're the dealer using his own stash, if you furnish drugs, it's a felony. They actually threatened to charge him with murder. And as a result of that threat, he entered into a resolution and he went to jail. He obviously sobered up in jail, came out, and the way he describes it is that he was sober, but he was completely depressed because he'd actually been arrested. They chose to arrest him the day of his final exams in college. So he had great grades and then went, you know, into custody, came out, he'd been kicked out of school. All of the classes now at this point, he failed because you couldn't even, you know, do an incomplete type of a situation. He had to move back home because the media coverage over in his college town was so bad that he couldn't go hardly anywhere without people talking about it or mentioning it. And anyone that's been to Chico, it's a college town. Everybody kind of knows everybody. So it's just this huge scarlet letter. He got back. Now he doesn't have a degree. He doesn't, you know, have stable living. He just starts kind of bartending and just trying to make it by and trying to stay sober because he has very, very strict probation terms when he gets out. Of course, those include drug testing. You know, those include classes. Those include probation appointments, all of that. And when I met him, I mean, he was still him, I can imagine. You know, he's funny, he's smart. I'm thinking, what in the heck is this guy doing? Like working, he worked at the little restaurant next to my law office and he would just crack all of us up. And I'm thinking, what in the heck is this guy doing here? And so when I learned his story, I thought, geez. And so fast forward, so he eventually graduated from Sac State. He went back to college and he succeeded in that. We were able to actually expunge his felony, which is very difficult to do. We were able to do it. And the reason it was done, in my opinion, I did it for him, was the judge who reviewed our petition. We got the full file. It was actually transferred over here to Placer because he lived here in Placer. So his probation was moved over here. This old retired judge looked at this and said, I don't even understand why, you know, they were threatening him. This autopsy, you know, showed that there were, because I don't want to say anything ill of this young lady either. There were multiple substances in her system, but the substance that he had brought, the amount could not have killed her. Just couldn't have. So he never knew that. And so when the judge found out that he had not ever known for the past like 10 years that he basically not killed somebody, he said, you know what? He's done enough. I'm going to grant this. And so he granted it, and that allowed him to then go and get a job for the Secretary of State. So he started working at the Secretary of State. He got promoted at the soonest available opportunity, and he was just doing great. But loving an addict is hard because it's just always there. And, you know, anybody that has addiction issues knows that it's very, very difficult not to find new vices. And so, you know, booze weren't really his vice, but suddenly he'd be drinking too much, right? Or he would have, you know, a relapse and then he'd be so disappointed in himself. Or, you know, eventually when he did pass away, it was a condition that resulted from his drug use. And I think he would be really, really disappointed because he always said that his biggest, you know, fear was that if he ever passed away, that he would be leaving his mom, me, his brother, his sister, his dad, and he never wanted to inflict that pain. So he did really, really well. And any sort of struggles he had or relapses he had, he addressed them really quickly. And, you know, we dealt with them because when you're, excuse me, when you're loving an addict, because by the way, it's pretty easy to love an addict in terms of falling in love with one. Addicts are, in my opinion, probably some of the most interesting people. That's usually why people have addiction issues, is because their brains are going a million miles a minute. There's a reason some of our greatest musicians and artists and authors, so Stephen King, he wrote almost all of his books on cocaine, right?
And NyQuil.
I will not even go down the list of our famous artists that can't, I mean, seriously, that's not a coincidence. And so those two things often go hand in hand, where some of the most interesting people also have addiction issues. So at some point, you have to make a decision. Well, is it worth it? Because this person is like, I want to talk to this person every day for the rest of my life, but they have an addiction issue. Or do I want to find somebody who I don't ever have to worry about, someone that doesn't have any addiction issues, and it'll
that's
be easy.
Fucking boring.
But that's not what I want. So I decided, obviously, the former. And you always kind of, you know, in the back of your head know that it could possibly happen. Yeah. It did. But most importantly, I would note that it... Right now, especially addiction, I am super concerned about anybody that does have any addiction issues, because fentanyl has hit the market. And so fentanyl is found in a lot of street drugs now, and they're not even the ones that have been usually regarded as dangerous. Here would be an example.
Right.
There was a huge Adderall shortage. There has been periodically in the past few years. So Adderall is, you know, a legal prescription. When there's a shortage and somebody is now being told they're not going to get Adderall for a few weeks or a few months, and they go buy Adderall and there's fentanyl in it, I don't really consider that person to have been intentionally trying to, like, right? That's actually someone who's trying to, like, bridge the gap. They don't. And then what happens? Well, fentanyl will kill you immediately, right? So it used to be, well, even if I relapse, you know, an overdose, if you will, that's because somebody is using heroin or they're using methamphetamine or they're using something and they've used so much of it now, you know, that's happened. And now overdoses or with fentanyl, when I say a condition, for example, is that if it's not technically an overdose, fentanyl can trigger underlying conditions. So it can trigger heart attacks. It can trigger aneurysms and things of that nature. And it's making things much more dangerous even for, and I hate to say the casual drug user, but that's what I'm going to say. It's no longer just a risk for people who are going into full blown, you know, overdoses. This is people who have education and jobs and maybe had addiction issues, and even the tiniest relapse can be deadly. And so that's more or less, you know, what happened with JC, and we lost him. And it's difficult, as you can tell, for me to even talk about, but it is important because it's yet another thing that we now have to, you know, deal with. So if you struggle with addiction issues and you're like JC and your greatest fear is, you know, leaving your loved ones behind, it's no longer just, you know, you going out and really doing a lot of drugs or alcohol. It's a danger even with the tiniest relapse or even with the tiniest attempt to use any type of substance. And so hopefully, and I see it in my work a lot as well. This one just happens to be obviously very personal to me. But yeah, anybody that knew him, he was wonderful. And he passed away having not died with just like the addict label, right? He had a little list that I had found of all the things like he wanted to do. And he'd done almost all of them in terms of going back to school and getting his degree, getting real job. I had to laugh. He had real health benefits. I remember laughing. He was so excited the day that his health benefits vested. He is a pretty boy. Man, he was so excited about dental insurance. He's like, do you think they'll cover teeth whitening? And so he was so excited. I think it's also important to note, because even though obviously his story ended in tragedy, that in between, he was really, really happy. And it was really nice to see that he wasn't just defined in the balance of his life by, you know, that substance abuse issue. He wasn't defined by any minor relapse he had in between. You know, he went on and he was able to do a lot of really great things. And I think he would have done a ton more if he'd had the opportunity.
Well, I thank you so much for opening up about that and talking about that. I know it's not easy, and God, it's so man, it just hurts. The thing that stuck out to me in the beginning, that's so sad and then also like really infuriating, is imagine, you know, somebody, hey, try this in college, and we think it's just fun. Is it the Sacklers? They fought so hard to get this drug approved and say it wasn't addictive, and it was such fucking bullshit. It was such a lie, and they knew it. And like, I've watched the documentaries and the shows, and like one of them, I watched like one or two episodes and I had to turn it off because it infuriates me. It makes me so mad. And to imagine like an 18-year-old kid, like, hey, this is just for fun, try this out, and it's like the most addicting thing possible existing on the fucking planet. Like, that is so sad and frustrating and infuriating. I love what you said about addicts, and I want to double back on it for our listeners, because I'm what you might call a rehab connoisseur. I've been to about five of them, and I swear to, I have met the coolest, most intelligent, most interesting fucking people in rehab. And one of my favorite phrases is, we're not bad people trying to get good, we're good people trying to get better. And you hit it right on the head, at least for these two addicts, because Cameron and I, we got this thing, the hamster wheel. It's going a million miles per hour, where every which way. And you know, you talked about it, the self-medicating thing, man. When a lot of my addiction early on was just me trying to get my brain to shut the fuck up. But I think it's so funny that you mentioned that, touched on, perceived it, because all my friends that are addicts, you know, I've met the coolest fucking people, and they're not bad people. They're not. They've just, you know, been hit with this issue, however it happened to them, however it came to them. And it sucks, man. It's really hard. And JC, you know, for example, was like the bubbliest person. He always greeted you with a smile and, hey, Dan, let's go. He's a little frisky, little dance or whatever. You know, he was like a fucking little ray of sunshine, man. And it breaks my heart to think about it, but I do think that's really important. I know a lot of people can relate with what you said, and I hope it feels a little bit good for you to be able to talk about it, because I don't know how much you get to talk about it or to talk about it.
Yeah, and I think
I appreciate being able to talk about it, because another thing that kind of happens is, you know, when you lose somebody, you know, people don't know how to react, and they don't, you know, they don't want to ask. And then it feels uncomfortable to just kind of bring it up. And then more importantly, knowing JC, because Henry's right. I mean, man, he is a talker. He's, you know, loves to socialize. He loved to help people. He was happy. Like, he would have been the exact person that if he was down here, he'd been like, oh, no, we're going to talk about this. And, you know, he, I think, would want people to be able to keep talking about him and not just completely like ignore, you know, everything that he did. We celebrated his birthday this weekend, And so I was able to spend the day with his family. And, you know, his mom and I were just talking about that, that, you know, just telling stories can be really fun. And this is one of those stories. It's the biggest story. And it's one that, you know, doesn't get told very often, if ever, outside of our little family and friends. But I appreciate being able to do it. And so, and if it resonates with anybody at all, then that's, then that would be wonderful. And I know he would appreciate that.
Yeah. And I think it is going to resonate with a lot of people, because a lot of people's stories, especially a lot of our listeners, a lot of our friends as well, their story all kind of started almost exactly like that, right? Like they were handed an Oxycontin at one point during that time frame, and some did prison sentences. Some's lives went in complete shambles, some overdosed, and, you know, some have died, you know, and it's the saddest story. And it sucks that JC had to go down like that. I met JC a couple times at some parties. He was a very lively cat. Like you guys explained, I wasn't close with him, but he was always super nice to me when I saw him. I was blacked out drunk and probably on like three ecstasy pills, but I was having the time of my life. You know, I will reiterate what Henry said. You know, I'm glad that you see it as well. One of my favorite ladies in one of the meetings that I go to always mentions this. She goes, us addicts and alcoholics have a special shine about us. We're not like the normal people out there outside in the real world. We got that special shine, and that's why I love all you guys in here. And she says it all the time, and I'm just like, damn right, lady in the meeting. I don't even know her name, but I just smile and nod. I'm like, fuck yeah, dude. I'm shining in here, brother. Like, I'm shining. But it's true. We're not lame, and we are unique. We have messed up brains, but I mean, we deal with it. But I do appreciate your willingness to talk about it. And I like to believe that he would have been more than okay with you coming on here and talking with Henry and my ass about it. Especially because it's for the right cause, right? Like this podcast is to help people to take the veil off of what substance abuse is, what it looks like from two people who battle with it, and how it affects people like yourself. So I really do appreciate you bringing it up, and you could hear it in your voice. And I hope that it brings you some solace. Speaking about him right now, like you just did, keeps his legacy alive in my eyes. So don't ever stop talking about him. Don't ever forget him, because I promise you, he hasn't forgotten you. And that's what I wanted to say about that. So thank you for bringing that up, Michelle. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we have to get going. I want to thank you again for coming on. I want to say send a terroristic threat your way for beating me in fantasy football by the narrowest margin possible. Bills and Dolphins. Who you got, Michelle?
I think I'm going to go Dolphins because I love Mike McDaniel.
He is the absolute man. You know what? I got family members who are Finns fans, so I'm gonna rock with the Finns as well.
I guess I'll be contrarian and go Bills.
I knew you were gonna do it.
Wait, so before we get out of here, we always ask our guests two questions, and we'll figure out. I think we can spin it for you, because most of our guests are addicts. But you've experienced kind of recovery and stuff through me and through your clients. So what is your favorite part about recovery?
I think probably my favorite part about recovery is, and I'm thinking about JC a little bit in this, and I'm thinking about you a little bit in this. And without being too specific about either of you, the moment when you don't actively like worry about somebody anymore, when just every time you see him, it's like, this is the new them. Not, oh, it's been a week. Oh, good job, man. Good job. Oh, it's been a month. Oh, you're doing so good. You know, hey, it's 6 months, you know, let's go to dinner. But you're really still worried. You're waiting for the other foot to drop. And then just the day that I have a friend or a loved one where it's not even a worry. Like, no offense, Henry, but I did not like Henry when he used to come around and he
I was waiting for this.
Drained all the time. I didn't like him. and I thought it was annoying. I kicked him out of our league. I just did not like him. Yeah. And it's super funny because I love him now. I mean, I absolutely do. But I also am not constantly like, oh, Henry's coming? Great. You know, was he going to be out in the parking lot sipping vodka again? I'm like, Henry's coming? Hey, I'll fly Henry out here. Is Henry coming? This is the same with JC. You know, because if someone's an addict, you know, if JC is having trouble or something, I didn't even want to, you know, schedule a vacation because I'm like, is he even going to be able to get on the plane? And then the years and years and years we had where that wasn't even a concern, it were peaceful and wonderful. And it's hard to even pinpoint when that happens a certain day, but you know when it does and it feels really good and I like seeing it.
Nice. And I'll ask our last question and then we will get you out of here. Look at you. She's been in court all day. I really got to thank you. I mean, this is incredible. You got a work ethic of it's very admirable. You're a better person than I am. I'd have been like, dude, I'm not doing this shit. Why am I talking to these two fucking losers, man? I make like $1 million an hour. Okay. So here we go. What would you tell somebody that is struggling right now?
I'd probably tell someone that's struggling right now that I don't care how bad it is, like there's a way up. I remember with JC, you know, with the felony, he never ever thought there was a way up. I don't care if you have to call your lawyer. I don't care if you have to call your pastor. I don't care if you have to just hear me say it. There is always a way out. I don't even care if you end up in prison. When you get out, there's a way up. And there's many, many people who become incredibly successful and in fact, hyper successful because you have to use a lot more creativity and ingenuity when you have that sometimes, whether it be a criminal record or whether it be, I got to stay away from, I mean, as an example, I had a friend who, you know, worked for an alcohol sales company and at some point, you know, had to leave because you're even limited by maybe what you can be around, who you can be around. Nope, there's always a way up and I don't care how creative you have to be, do it. And if you do it well, you can end up being very, very successful and happy. It's going to take a while, possibly, but there's always a way up and out.
Love that. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for giving us your time. You don't know it, but we've already volunteered you for a segment called Legal Questions with Trigger. So we'll be having you back to answer questions. But we will give a shout out and a rest in peace to our brother JC.
Rest in peace.
I'm really glad we got to talk about him. Cameron and I talk about it all the time. The best way to honor them is to keep their memory alive and talk about them. So we love you, JC. And we love you, Michelle. Thank you very much for your time and for coming on.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Michelle. Take care, all right?
Bye.
Bye. Damn, dog. That was probably the most informative, wonderful, infuriating, and heartwarming episode we've ever done. I felt all the spectrum of those emotions the entire time. I was just like, damn, this is super fucked up. Damn, I'm pissed off. Then I'm making threats against the Capitol. Like, damn, I'm going to prison. And then I'm just like all these things. Then I'm sad about JC and then smiling and laughing. But dude, so awesome for her to come on. What a great guest. What a smart, intelligent, wonderful woman. And tragedy can strike any of us, man. I mean, it's the sad reality of this life, man.
That was a roller coaster of emotion, huh? Dude, I get fired up when I think about how they got away with the fucking, you know, they made, I don't know the numbers, but they made like $7 billion off Oxy and they had to pay like $7 million in fines,
dude,
or something.
Don't even bring it up.
So infuriating.
I'm going to go out so here and start screaming at my kids and shit, dude. I can't have it, man. We can't talk about that. No, I'm not, dude.
Yeah.
Strike two, dude.
Two strikes, one podcast.
It's two strikes, dude. Operation Take the Cree Down, dude. Can we get him mad enough to make enough threats to send him to prison for life? Anyways, dude, I'm gonna give you a quick Creerens quote, and then I do got to get the fuck out of here, dude. Right. Here it is. You ready? And it's about it. It's nice with recovery. Here it is. He goes, it's not the load that breaks you down. It's the way that you carry it. Lena Horne. So true. So true, man. It's, we can run around here and carry these types of things. Like, who knows? Maybe Michelle was carrying JC's, you know, death for a long time. It's, it can wear you down if you don't carry it properly. I know I do that a lot with my worries and my insecurities, bro. You know what I mean? And it can wear you the fuck down. So, try to find a new, healthier way of doing it that doesn't involve getting loaded.
Absolutely.
All right. You got anything else, brother?
I do not, man. I feel heavy and light. I feel a lot of emotions right now. I don't even know. I don't even know where I'm at with, but that was really cool. And I really appreciate her coming on. And, it's great to have people on all different sides of addiction, because she experiences it in multiple different ways. So it's very interesting to hear another perspective like that, you know?
It is, dude. And yeah, it's like that infamous, the post-pod zooting that I like to call it. Like, I'm always podcast high, dude. Like, when I walk out, when we have banger episodes like this, I like walk out, I'm like, dude, the world's great. I feel fantastic. Everything's fine. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris aren't running for president. Everything's all right, dude. We're okay. Anyways, I'm going to finish this like I always do. Actually, first I skipped something. Look at, dude, we're still rusty. Having you back's fucking me up. Follow us on everything. If you're a new listener, this is us. Welcome. We love you. All people are welcome here. Hit the follow button. Share it with a friend and stick around, because we have lots of other fun shenanigans and all sorts of really informative episodes. And now I will finish it like I always do. Hen, I love you very much. Michelle, thank you again for coming on.
I love you too, Cam, and I would be remiss if I didn't thank everyone who took the time out of their day to send me a message of love and support for the last episode. Thank you. Thank you to a million. I really appreciate it. Also, rest in peace, JC, and be yourself and fuck what they think.
You can now just call me Three Strike Cree. I'm going to jail, dude. Later, dude.